astonished at the size of the audience. I guess that's because I gave a very general title and a very minimal abstract. And so maybe people thought it's accessible to them. So the problem with my general title and minimal abstract is when I started thinking about, okay, so the way this came about is there are certain things that Zenghan and I decided we would like to sort of cover or think about during this quarter, and I said, oh, we got to get started because it's already week two and I'm gone next week, so I better get started. So I'll give an introduction today. And then when I started to think about how do you do an introduction to supersymmetry and geometry in 1 hour, I kind of panicked. So I'm going to tell you some aspects of this. Some parts are going to be detailed, and some parts are going to be pretty vague. But let me mention my basic source, which is three things. Okay, so there's notes on supersymmetry. There's super homework. And there's super solutions. And these are all contained in the book called Quantum Fields and Strings. I'm so tempted to just write the acronym, but then nobody will know what I'm talking about. A Guide for Mathematicians. That might not be the right title, but it's close. Which is a book. And it's a book which is sort of edited by lots of people, famous people, and then less famous people, and then more famous people. Okay. Actually, Witten might not be an editor. I think maybe he made us do all the work. I think that might be. He was the lecturer. So there was a special year at the Institute for Advanced Study in 1996-97 in which an attempt was made to seriously teach a bunch of mathematicians about supersymmetric things, quantum field theory, and Zeiberg-Witten theory was pretty new, and that was kind of our goal, was to learn that. And so there were a lot of people lecturing, but Witten did give a lot of lectures. And then a lot of us took notes, and so we sort of wrote up the book. And at one point, Witten gave us what was called the super homework. So I will explain how we got the super homework. So we had homework, and we were supposed to do the homework, and we had problem sessions, and we had a TA at our problem sessions, and the TA was Edward Witten. And there was a day, this is being recorded. I will tell nothing but the truth. There was a day in which our TA tried to get somebody to come to the board to solve a problem. That's what TAs do. And finally, Deline agreed to come to the board and solve a problem. And Deline explained why the problem had not been formulated correctly in the mathematical terms, instead of solving the problem. And Witten got annoyed with all of us and said several things, including, I don't understand why we can teach this material to first-year graduate students, but we can't teach it to mathematicians. Another thing that he said was that if we don't understand supersymmetry, we can't possibly get to Zeiberg-Witten theory. And so he went home and sat down and typed out a 12-page problem set for us, which was the super homework. And then Deline and Fried wrote Super Solutions, which is about a 100-page response to the super homework. And again, I have to say, it was solved the way the mathematicians think about it, not the way physicists think about it. But that actually makes it a good way for mathematicians to approach it. And then in the same book, it is some sort of necessary background material, which is this notes on supersymmetry, which was done by Bernstein. So the super homework, this is Bernstein, Joseph Bernstein. This was Witten. He gave the homework, and then Deline and Fried solved it. Well, all of us worked on it, right? They wrote it up on behalf of everybody. So I want to try to explain supersymmetry. And at its most basic level, it's about algebraic structures. So there's a supersymmetry algebra, and we have to understand what these algebraic structures are. And essentially, there's a sort of collection of results in which you take some kind of structure and you turn it into a Z2 gradient structure. But Z2 gradient is too fancy a term. It's just called a superstructure. Okay. Some of the words you get by prepending super suggest something else, so I have to be careful. But mathematical terms usually don't have a secondary meaning. Superstructure has a meaning as an English word, right? So, for example, we can take a Lie algebra, and we can get a super Lie algebra. A vector space is a simpler thing. We can take a vector space, and we can get a super vector space. We can take a Lie algebra, and we can get a super Lie algebra. And so a vector space is something V. A super vector space is a V equals V0 plus V1. I said it was Z2 graded, so I'm grading it by 0 and 1. This can be called the even part. This can be called the odd part. And I'm certainly entitled to talk about homomorphisms that would between vector spaces that have such a structure, or endomorphisms of a vector space which has such a structure. It turns out that there is a right. So in particular, I can look at the homomorphisms from a super vector space, say to itself, or I can look at the invertible homomorphisms from a super vector space to itself. So I'm going to call the general linear group of the super vector space. The endomorphisms, right, of the super vector, this thing. Now, what makes it super is what you do with coordinates and functions of the super vector space. So what we want to do is introduce a basis, x1 to xk, of v0. And a basis psi1 to psi l of v1. And then the rule is going to be for making functions that xi and xj commute, but psi I and psi j skew commute, anti-commute. So this is where the fun starts. So what we're going to do in making super things is put appropriate signs into relations. So the vector space itself, there wasn't really much to do aside from saying that we're grading it v0 and v1. But we're going to take functions on that vector space, for example, polynomial functions on the vector space. Well, things that you might generate by some kind of multiplication, but the algebra structure is commutative in the even variables and anti-commutative in the odd variables. And when you think about this, that actually tells you that the functions, the natural functions, are, so let's take complex valued functions, just for simplicity. We could do reals as well. So it's the polynomial algebra on x1 up to xk, tensored with a Grassmann algebra on the vector space generated, vector space generated, it's the symmetric algebra on this guy. Let me write it the way I wanted to write it. It's the symmetric algebra on V0. So that's the usual polynomials in those variables, tensored with the skew symmetric algebra on V1. So because I'm building up an algebra on V1 in which the variables are set to anti-commute, I use the exterior powers there, and that's the algebra of all exterior powers, right? So this is a finite dimensional thing over the ground field. This is an infinite dimensional thing, the usual polynomial algebra, the symmetric algebra on the guy, and that's the sort of model set of functions that we use to think about things in supersymmetry. In Lie algebra theory, what do? You have to write down an algebra, a Lie bracket, and then there is a Jacobi identity, and the Jacobi identity has certain signs depending on whether we're working with even elements or odd elements. And so working out what's a good consistent set of signs is a funny exercise, but people have done it. And then all the other structures that will turn up always have some kinds of signs showing up when odd elements are present, which are all motivated by this basic sign that you want, that the reverse of multiplying two things should change the sign. Now, maybe I should have put also here the sign manifesto, which is by Deligne, because there are fundamental problems with choosing all of the signs. So one of the difficulties that mathematicians have in reading the physics literature about supersymmetry is that there are many sign conventions and the literature is not consistent. And so Deligne set himself the task of figuring out what the story was, and he realized that there really is not a natural choice. I mean, there's a reason for inconsistency, because if you decide to fix the sign a certain way over here, then it really looks unnatural over there, or you could decide over there, and then it looks unnatural over here. It's kind of like whack-a-mole. There are lots of places where you might make a natural choice of signs, and then that influences all the other places where you want signs. So I'm not going to try to write down anything with signs, but in the literature you can find things with signs. So if I want endomorphisms which respect this kind of structure, so I'm interested in endomorphisms respecting that kind of structure, well, one of the things which happens almost immediately is you realize that the familiar way that you might treat determinants doesn't work properly. In fact, the familiar way that you might treat traces doesn't work properly either. And the natural trace of an endomorphism . So what's my endomorphism look like? My endomorphism, I can sort of write in block form, right? I've got the V0 goes to V0 part, the V0 goes to V1, the V1 goes to V0, and the V1 goes to V1. And there will be matrix elements here, A11 down to AKK, and let's say B11 down to BLL, plus lots of other ones, but as usual, traces only care about those. And the natural trace is often denoted by supertrace. So the supertrace of this matrix is the sum of the A's minus the sum of the B's. So that's the thing which turns out to behave well with respect to conjugation and so on. If you're using rules for, composing endomorphisms, we should be putting in a sign when we compose endomorphisms. And it's that sign which means that these don't behave the usual way with respect to, for example, change of basis or conjugation by S and S inverse, but they behave in a slightly different way, and luckily it turns out to be not too bad. It's the trace of this part minus the trace of that part. Well, the determinant is the exponential of the trace, so the determinant is also going to have a funny property, and the determinant is replaced by... it's not usually called the superdeterminant. It's called the Berezinian bare of the matrix, AK, B1 to BLL, whatever. I mean, we've got all these parts. And, so there's a Berezinian, which is invariant under conjugation. That's the key property that you want for endomorphisms. It turns out that unlike the determinant, the Berezinian is only well defined on endomorphism, on GL I want to be automorphisms, right? Not just endomorphisms. So the determinant is defined on all endomorphisms from a vector space to itself, but the Berezinian turns out to only be defined on the invertible ones, on the automorphisms. And it has the property that, not so easy to define. Most definitions use a pretty abstract formulation, so one way of defining the determinant is to look at the top exterior power of the space and decide that if you have a homomorphism, there's a unique sk scalar, which operates on the top exterior power, and that's the determinant. And you can kind of do that with a super vector space, but it's more complicated. But anyway, if you have an automorphism with the property that the off-diagonal parts are the zero homomorphism, so there's no 1 to 0 part and no 0 to 1 part, then this turns out to be the determinant of A divided by the determinant of B. And that's nicely compatible with this. If you'd had a matrix like that, you would have expected to exponentiate this in some way, but the exponential of the A's would have been the determinant of A, the exponential of the B's got a sign, they were the determinant of B, but they go in the denominator. Okay, so why is this important for geometry? It's important because if I'm doing manifolds, the first step is I have to understand how change of coordinates work and how I can use change of coordinate formulas to understand integrals, which are defined sort of coordinate chart by coordinate chart. And so you get a Jacobian determinant, right, for your change of basis matrix. But if I'm going to try to do that in this super context, I'm going to have what you might call a Jacobian Bayesian. I've never actually heard anybody use that term, where you have to essentially, well, if your change of variables is of the form where the x's change among themselves and the psi's change among themselves only, then you'll simply take the ratio of the change of variables determinants, the Jacobian determinants for the two sets. If it's more complicated, and you might wonder how it can be more complicated in this context, but for example, although x is even and psi is odd, but if you have two psi's and psi 1, psi 2 is even, and so you could replace x by x plus psi 1, psi 2, and that would be a graded change of variables, and so then you have to use the more complicated ways of evaluating Bayesian. But if you don't do that, then you could just take the ratio of the two things. And putting the Jacobian determinant in the denominator instead of the numerator affects in a dramatic way what happens when you do elementary integration. So elementary integration changes in this super context, and that's important for what's to come.
So Dave, yeah. Bayesian, does it preserve product too?
Yes.
Or does?
Super prop. So, I mean, yes. Whatever. Right. Yes, Bayesian is a homomorphism from the GL of the space to a one-dimensional guy. So how might I do? So I'm going to use this model space, which I could think of as symmetric polynomials in ordinary polynomials in this many variables, and then a kind of wedge of a vector space generated by, I don't really know what notation I'm using, psi 1 to psi out, something like that. So I've got symmetric and skew symmetric polynomials, and that's my sort of model space. Maybe I should do reals right now because I'm about to try to talk about manifolds. So a super manifold is a locally ringed space. Okay, so algebraic geometers love thinking about manifolds this way. Other people might not. So in algebraic geometry, we always think of algebraic varieties as being locally ringed spaces, which are isomorphic to some model locally ringed space called an affine algebraic variety. And similarly, you can use that same story. If you're using, for example, C infinity functions on a smooth manifold, you can think of the smooth manifold as being a locally ringed space, which is locally isomorphic to some model space, which in that case would be a nice domain in Rn. Right? So for supermanifold, I'll take a locally ringed space, which is locally isomorphic, whose functions are locally isomorphic to my model ring R on some open set U in RK. I don't really have any extent to the variables psi 1 through psi L. Those variables all square to 0, right? So psi I, it's a consequence of the skew symmetry, psi I squared is equal to 0. And if you have a bunch of psi's in a row, which are distinct, that's great, that then you get something non-zero. But if you start writing too many of them down, it's impossible to avoid repeating them or avoid linear combinations of the previous ones. So for example, psi 1 up to psi L times any linear combination of the psi's has to vanish because each of these is repeated someplace in here, and so it causes the term to vanish. So I already mentioned that this was a finite dimensional vector space. Instead of being a bunch of coordinates where you can go, it behaves as what algebraic geometers would call a bunch of nilpotent elements in the ring. The ring is not commutative. The ring is super commutative. So isn't that a great word? You just put super in front of everything. The ring is super commutative. So it's not quite algebraic geometry that we're doing unless we only have one psi, in which case it is commutative. But still, the idea of some kind of nilpotent fuzz, which isn't really quite geometric, is part of the story. And that means I should be taking open set U like this. Now, what I've actually just defined is a split supermanifold. And there's a slightly more general definition in which there can be some variation of the... and I should also mention these are called Grossmann variables. Sometimes. So there can be some variation of the Grossmann variables over the set U, I don't want to try to get into the technicalities of split supermanifolds, but this is a good class of examples for us to look at. So now I want to do integrals on such a space. So for example, I typically will want to do a top degree integral. So I'll want to take all of my even variables and all of my odd variables as the things I'm integrating over, and then I'll have some function of these even and odd variables. And I'd like to know how to do those integrals. As I just mentioned, the behavior of the Berezinian means that the integral of the Grossmann variables is going to be rather different than the ordinary integral. So, for example, the basic rule is that the integral of dx is equal to x, right? Plus c, sorry. it's x, right? So, on the other hand, if you took the integral of d psi, you would end up getting 0, but the integral of psi d psi gives 1. Well, somehow you would have expected that the derivative of the function psi gave 1, not 0, and that the derivative of the function 1 gave 0. And so the kind of moral of the story is that integrating on a supermanifold is roughly the same thing with respect to the Grossmann variables, the odd variables, is roughly the same thing as taking the derivative of the function in the Grossmann variable set. Okay, so what we're about to write down is, what I'm going to try to write down is a rough description of what's called super Minkowski space. So it's a model place where we can try to do some physics. We'll do probably super Euclidean space. There's not a huge difference between super Euclidean and super Minkowski. The point will be that we then want, and so it's going to have some automorphisms, which generalize the translations that are present in Euclidean or Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, they're called boosts as well. And then we want to understand how to do integrals of expressions. And the natural thing to use somehow as the differentiation operator that's at play is one that respects the translation symmetry in a nice way. So you have to modify the naive one to be It's the analog of being Lorentz covariant, or just covariant in differential geometry. What we'll find, roughly speaking, is that carrying out the integration over the odd variables ends up taking derivatives, and it won't just be because of the mixture that you need for this covariant derivative thing. It will actually end up potentially taking derivatives of with respect to the x's of the function f. So I want to kind of state that as an important principle in why supersymmetry, when applied to physical theories, ends up being interesting. And the principle is that when you integrate some expression that's going to be used to define your physical theory, now maybe I should call it S, because that's the letter that people use. When you do this integral, integrating over the size takes derivatives of S. So before kind of explaining how this all works, I just want to give a kind of example of the relation between geometry and supersymmetry, so that if I get too technical later on, you'll at least have seen one reason why this principle is useful. And my example is going to be a case where you have two supersymmetry generators. And so if I have two supersymmetry generators, then that means I'm potentially going to be integrating d psi 1, d psi 2. Okay, so I'm slightly going to cheat. Actually, for this example to really work the way I'm telling you about it, I actually need four supersymmetry generators, not two. But it's a little hard for me to explain in a limited time why that would be true. So let me just pretend that I only need two. So I'm going to imagine I've got some kind of function and some number of even variables, and I do the integral so that I get something like two derivatives with respect to something. I don't quite know what. Let me just call them S and T1 and T2. We have to work out what that means, but I get two derivatives of something as a result. And now I've gotten rid of my strange-looking Grassmann variables, and I'm back in slightly more familiar territory in physics, where I might be trying to write down some kind of physical action that describes a theory. And that action is going to have two more derivatives than it initially had. So as an example, one of the things which might go in an action, you might be considering a physical theory which started on a manifold. This is an ordinary manifold. Sorry, started on ordinary spacetime. So let me just call it k minus 1, comma 1, because I had k even variables. And it was a physical theory based on maps into a manifold x. Now, to write down an appropriate physical Lagrangian for this theory, I typically need x to have a metric. I'm going to pull back that metric and use it to measure the length of the scalar fields, which are serving as the coordinates on x, and I'll put that into my Lagrangian. And then typically in the Lagrangian, I'll have things in this case, such as components of this metric, gij, pulled back, but in physics language you almost never write V upper star, pulled back to the space, and then I'll have some fields that are taking values in the manifold X. And so when I sum over something like that, I'm essentially evaluating the metric on those two particular fields. So that's a typical, and there will be other terms as well, but that's a typical kind of term that's the kinetic term for the fields in a nonlinear sigma model, for those who know the language. So if I were to hope to do such a thing in the context of a supersymmetric theory, where I was going to end up getting two derivatives of my action, then I'll need to be able to write the GIJ as two derivatives of something. And it turns out there's a natural context in which you could do that. If X is a Cantor manifold, well, in particular, that means it has a complex structure, and I can use complex notation for the coordinates. So I'm really going to call the coordinates z alpha and z alpha bar, something like that. Then it turns out that if you write down g alpha beta bar, okay, so on a Cantor manifold, you would have a bunch of GIJs, but it turns out that the only ones that are non-zero are the ones which have one holomorphic and one anti-holomorphic index. So the GIJ bar, G alpha beta bar, has the very nice property that it's the second derivative with respect to alpha and beta bar of some function, which we'll call script K, and this is known as the Kähler potential. The Kähler potential is only locally defined on the manifold. It's not global. But any two Kähler potentials differ by the sum of a holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic function. So I could take f of z and maybe g of z bar, something like that. And if you take a holomorphic function or an anti-holomorphic function and add them, you'll end up with another Kähler potential. Well, that's perfectly suited for here. So whereas in a theory of this kind, you might have ended up with the metric on the target manifold determining essentially some kind of coefficients in your Lagrangian, here, and those coefficients can vary, here, in this supersymmetric context, you'll be able to write down a super version of the action, which involves the Kähler potential rather than the metric. And then integrating out the odd variables will end up producing for you a Kähler metric on the space. So I presented this as an example, but it turns out that for theories with an appropriate kind of supersymmetry and maybe one minor condition imposed on the theory, then the only time you can have this kind of sigma model as a target is if it is a Kähler manifold, so that this turns out to be the only way to kind of integrate up twice from the components of a metric on a target space and end up with something that's suitable for use in a physical theory. I should have mentioned that, well, okay, I'm not going to mention that. Any questions? Anybody with me? Everybody? Yes.
It's always, I couldn't figure out this integral. That's a definite integral or indefinite integral?
Yes.
You write it up.
Yes.
It's a definite
integral? Yes. It is.
But there's no...
So people do physical theories in finite volume, and then it's a definite integral, and you have to worry about the boundary. And they do physical theories in infinite volume. In that case, you do an indefinite integral. It's a definite integral, but typically it's being integrated over the entire space. So you don't have to worry about boundary conditions. But sometimes people do the theories in finite volume, and then they have to worry about what the boundary conditions are. Okay, so that's my example of how having this integration that's really like differentiation leads to a restriction on the properties of the physical theory. So, so an outline of what I would like to do, although because I don't have a lot of time, I won't do it today, is to tell you what Super-Minkowski space is. So I would start out with a Minkowski space, MK minus 1, 1. And then I also have to choose have to study the spinner bundle on Minkowski space. because the geometric interpretation of the geometric interpretation of the anti-commuting variables is going to be things which are taking values in the natural spinner bundle over this manifold. So Minkowski space is just RK, but it's RK whose metric has signature with metric of signature. Well, there are two conventions, the left, the West Coast and East Coast conventions. But anyway, I'll say minus, plus, plus, plus. That's the one I like. But there are some people who like plus, minus, minus, minus. So I take the spinner bundle over that, and I make a supermanifold out of that spinner bundle together with the space. So the spinner bundle is some S, which is going to be spinners, set of spinners, which is a vector space. It's also a representation of the spin group of RK minus 1, 1. And I haven't said what a spinner is, and if you don't know what spinners are, I will say something about them in a few minutes. But what I'm going to do to make a supermanifold is introduce an operation called, which I can do on vector spaces, called reverse parity. So reverse parity gives me an odd vector space whose which is isomorphic to S as a non-graded vector space. So all I'm doing is declaring all the elements of S to be odd. And then the superspace is just the Minkowski space crossed with the odd version of this vector space. And when I take functions on it, I can take polynomial functions or C-infinity functions, whatever ring of functions is appropriate, on the Minkowski space part. I could also do this for Euclidean, by the way, but there are the properties of spinners change when you change signature of the quadratic form. And so to get the right thing for physics, you really want to study the spinner bundle of the indefinite signature vector space, inner product space. I take this as a manifold in which these are the odd variables, the things which are spinner valued are odd variables, and these are the ordinary even variables on the manifold. And so I'm going to have x's, and I'm going to have psi's, and I'll be able to make sense of integrals, which are now taken to be integrals over this entire space, including all the psi's, where now there's some sort of maybe physical context to this thing. If I'm able to do the psi integrals, then I'll be faced with a Lagrangian formulation of a physical theory in Minkowski space, which is a more familiar object. That Lagrangian formulation, when you integrate out the psi variables, may still involve some even expressions in psi. So the difference between things only depending on the x's, I'm just going to symbolically write it like this. If I integrate out the psi part, I'm going to end up with, you know, an effective expression, but it may still involve the psi variables, although it now has to be a completely even expression. So that means that I can have things that are quadratic in the psi's, and that will only show up if I have two different psi's. I can have things which are quadratic in the psi's making an appearance here. But these vector spaces have dimension roughly 2 to the k, and so there are going to be lots of psi's in almost every context. So you can have things like a psi-psi term, or a psi-psi-psi-psi term, and these psi's in physical language turn out to be what are called Fermi fields or fermions, and having expressions in Lagrangians that have an even number of fermions is a familiar thing to encounter for people studying particle physics. Okay, so super Minkowski space has a related symmetry group, which is called the super Poincaré group. And super Poincaré acts transitively on super Minkowski. And I'll explain what is generalizing and then explain how it generalizes to the super context. So when I have ordinary Minkowski space, it has the Lorentz group of symmetries. And the Lorentz group is just the orthogonal group for the appropriate signature. Whether you're doing orientation preserving things or not is sort of the question. That indefinite orthogonal, this indefinite special orthogonal group has four components. And so you have to think about what you want to do with the component group. There's interesting physics associated to those questions, but I'm not going to get into them. But in addition to that Lorentz group, so if I were doing Euclidean, by the way, which is more familiar to mathematicians, then I would have just had the orthogonal group, right, of K. And now I can extend that by translations. And that's called the Poincaré group. And over here, it's called the Euclidean group. So I can extend rotations and reflections by the translations and get a group that acts, preserving the metric structure, that acts transitively on all of the Euclidean space. When I do it in Lorentz signature, I get a group that acts transitively in all of Lorentz space. It's transitive because of the translation part, but it also has the metric preserving aspect to it. And a choice of positive cone, forward light cone, is another geometric aspect of this, if you want to get the theories to behave properly. Okay, so how am I going to do super Poincaré? Well, I have two options. I can try to talk about a supergroup or a superalgebra. A supergroup is a supermanifold, and when we get into this whole supermanifold machinery, it's much easier to talk about the superalgebra. So let me first talk about the Poincaré algebra. And the Poincaré algebra should just be the corresponding little ok minus 1, 1. Again, semi-direct. The translation group has infinitesimal translations that again reproduce the vector space, so it looks just like an abelian Lie algebra of translations. And one of the points is that this algebra is actually also the algebra of the double cover spin. Well, sorry, since I'm doing O, I actually have to do pin K minus 1, 1. If I had been smart enough to do, and here it's SO, by the way, because the difference between O and SO does not show up in the algebra. Okay, so it is true that it's the algebra of spin and spin. So SO K minus 1, 1, or SO PQ for any signature P and Q, has a double cover, which is called the spinner group, and the spinners are a representation of the spinner group, which does not descend to a representation of the orthogonal group. And that causes all sorts of interesting complications. That sign, if you were trying to do things in the spinners as opposed to the orthogonal group, is another manifestation of the sign that's being used for Z2 grading. So you have to make all those signs match up as well. And then So in my super algebra, I'm going to take this Poincaré algebra as the even part. So super algebra even, and then super algebra odd is going to be a direct sum of a number of copies of the spinner. Well, okay, So I get, so there are actually two kinds of spinner representation, and so I might have a number of copies of one of them and then a number of copies of the other. Whether or not you have one or two spinner representations depends on the parity of the dimension. And if it's even dimension, then there are both plus and minus spinner representations. And in principle, you could have a supersymmetry algebra which had different numbers of plus and minus spinners involved. And what you would like is to classify the types of physical particle that could occur by studying the representation theory of this super Poincaré algebra. So this is called super Poincaré. G0 plus G1. And the physically interesting cases are sort of cut down a lot by looking a little bit at the representation theory. So in this sort of classical field theory that I'm describing, a particle is a representation of, this is before I superize, of Poincaré particle's representation of Poincaré. This is an insight of Hermann Weyl. And the type of representation tells you what type of particle it is. So the trivial representation gives a particle that's called a scalar field, it's particle slash field, I should say. It's called a scalar field or scalar particle. Those are things which were the staple of theoretical physics for many decades before they were finally observed in nature. We finally have one. The Higgs is a scalar field, but we didn't really have them before that. The spinner representation. Okay, so you'll notice that if I'm talking about representations of the algebra, the spinner representation makes sense. If I want to talk about the representation of the group, then I have this problem with a double cover. It's a slightly strange object, but the spinner representation corresponds to a fermion, e.g. Higgs. E.g. electron. And it was a beautiful work of Dirac in the middle of the 20th century, which helped physicists understand how fermions worked in quantum field theory and how spinners were important in that discussion. And then if you have the standard or vector representation, that corresponds to a spin 1 boson, and the common example is a photon. So how do I do representation theory of this non-compact group? Well, I look at how the I look at the stabilizer of a point, so then I get a representation somehow of the orthogonal group. It's acting on the light cone. It's acting on some, so you have to distinguish between vectors of norm 1 and vector, excuse me, norm 0 and vectors not of norm 0. If it's vector of norm 0, that turns out to be a massless particle, it's on the light cone, and you study how the orthogonal group acts on that cone. Otherwise, you're not on the light cone, and the norm tells you something about the mass of the particle in physics. Again, the key thing has to do with the representation of the stabilizer, which is going to be either SO k minus 1 or SO k minus 2, depending on whether we're in the massive or massless case. For the photon, the massless photon, I point out that k is 4 for us as we're where we're living, and so there's this SO2, and that SO2 is a reflection of the polarization effect on photons, which we're all familiar with. They're polarizing filters, which there's physics in these various computations. Okay, so we can think of it as representations of the Poincaré algebra, that the algebra and group, of course, make it, there's a difference in getting the spin half story correct or not, but that's the basic dictionary. And now we try to look at representations of super Poincaré. So I stopped, by the way. These are the three representations that make up most of what we know about physics. There's also a representation which is the second symmetric product of the standard. In other words, things that have two symmetric vector indices, those are metrics. And the theory of metrics is the theory of gravitons. So this is a spin two boson, which is a graviton. And I think prior to the study of supersymmetry, most physicists would have told you that this was enough to exhaust all the physical phenomena that people expected. After supersymmetry got going, people learned that there's a spin 3/2 particle, which is called the Rarita-Schwinger field. And since we haven't observed supersymmetry in nature, we haven't observed that yet. We've observed the effects of gravity quite a bit. I think it's arguable that the first kind of direct observation of a graviton was LIGO in the last couple of years. So really, even though everybody believed that these were important objects, we really only saw them quite recently, whereas electrons and photons have been, have been around for a while. They've been around forever. they've been observable for quite some time. Okie dokie. So representations of super Poincaré. Well, if I have a representation, and so I should say, you could ask about higher spin. And the traditional answer is that when you try to write down a physical Lagrangian describing the physics of a higher spin theory, what you get doesn't make physical sense. There has been a resurgence in the study of higher spin particles in the last decade, less than a decade perhaps. But when you throw in one of them, you have to admit particles of infinitely large spin. And so it's much simpler to sort of not do that and just study particles that might have this limited set of spins. And in any dimension, you could make a similar list. This is the trivial representation, the spinner representation of one kind or another. Since four is an even dimension, there are two kinds of fermions, left moving and right moving. That's not quite, left-handed and right-handed is the term I'm looking for. There's the standard vector representation, like the photon. There's a symmetric power, and then there's the tensor of the spinner and the vector representation. That's what corresponds to spin 3/2. So we can talk about those in any dimension. And so you can restrict it to Poincaré, and you get some sum of representations. Representations are completely reducible for this guy. And so the collection of representations which form a single representation of the super Poincaré algebra, that's called a multiplet. And a multiplet will consist of a collection of particles which belong together in this super Poincaré group. So supersymmetry is the action, on this level, is the action of super Poincaré on super Minkowski space. That's very restrictive, and what we want to do is kind of generalize to more general manifolds, and the easiest way to do that is to talk about super manifolds that are modeled on super Minkowski space. And then on their tangent spaces, there will be an action of the super Poincaré algebra, and then we can make sense of this story. So this representation theory was worked out by Werner Naum and others in the late 70s, and it sort of leads to only a few solutions with the spins bounded by two. So if I only want this collection of particles, it turns out that there are only a few solutions. So I'm going to just list for you the solutions. Okay, so so more precisely, the action of the algebra, I want to make covariant in some appropriate way. So the Super-Poincaré algebra has some covariant action. And in coordinates, you can write this down. It'll involve analogs of covariant derivatives for the action. One thing I want to point out is that the algebra action of one of the translations is a has a square root in the Super-Poincaré algebra, namely the action on in a spinner direction. So it turns out that the odd elements of this algebra square to infinitesimal translations, and that's what actually allows the symmetry to interchange particles that have spin a half, spin three, or spin three halves with those that have integer spin, 0, 1, or 2. And that feature of the symmetry algebra was unexpected. It's not an algebra. In fact, there had been a very beautiful and famous result in the physics literature in the 60s, which said that there was no interesting way to combine an internal symmetry algebra with Poincaré if you had if you were limited to spins less than or equal to 2. But that's because they used algebras, not superalgebras. So once superalgebras came along, it was realized that you could make this nice combination and get these closely linked collections of particles. So let me say that the first case is M0,1/1. So the slash denotes the number of the dimension of the spaces of spinners or of Grassmann variables in this case. So one supercharge. Okay, so that I start out with no space and one time dimension. And how about, no space and one time dimension, I said it right. And one super direction. And this lets you write things like x dot squared or t dot, phi dot squared, and then there are probably going to be psi terms. You can write them as some integral over d psi, some simpler expression using a combined field that involves both phi and psi. That's a typical thing that happens. Then there's M2,1/3. And this is a theory of this is the theory of complex manifolds, Kähler metrics, and so on. Then there is a new theory in four dimensions, which is M3,1/4. And this turns out to be a theory of hyperkähler manifolds. Okay, anybody, many of you will know what Kähler manifolds are. Fewer of you will know what hyperkähler manifolds are, but it's a really interesting geometric structure. Then there's M5,1/8,0. So up until now, the supersymmetry algebra that I was looking at had the same number of left-handed and right-handed spinners, but at dimension 6, you end up with only left-handed spinners involved in the symmetry algebra, and this one is this one is related to, I think, what I'll call locally symmetric spaces. That's an oversimplification. It's only related to certain locally symmetric spaces. This is the most mysterious one. So it's not hard to write down supersymmetric Lagrangians in this formulation. In each case, I can increase the number of variables without increasing the number of odd variables, a number of even variables without increasing the number of odd, and still get a theory. So I get one supercharge at various dimensions, two at various dimensions. sorry, I can decrease the number of variables. So I can have two supercharges in 0 plus 1 dimensions, or 1 plus 1, four supercharges in fewer dimensions, eight supercharges in dimensions below 6, essentially just by taking some of the spatial variables to be constant. So these theories are very hard to describe directly. These theories have a very nicely worked out explicit way of writing down Lagrangians for the theories. There is a decent version of that story here, but it involves an infinite number of auxiliary variables, and it might not be the best way to approach it. So most of the discussions of these theories are formulated in these terms. And I'll just mention that this is where Seiberg-Witten theory shows up, although it shows up, it's this theory reduced to four dimensions where Seiberg-Witten theory shows up. And so if we're headed for that, we have to understand something about how that theory works. But typically, there's something wrong with my table here. If I give a continuation of this lecture, I'll fix it up. But I'm just realizing as I'm talking that there's something wrong with what I wrote. But anyway, this is the geometry here is that I just need a spin structure on the manifold. Okay, so I think I will stop there and ask if there are questions. Yes?
So I remember saw the word hyperplate or something. So is that the interpretation?
So these multiplets, particularly with low amounts of supersymmetry, are very familiar to people, and they've given them special names. So there's the vector multiplet, which means different things with different amounts of supersymmetry, but always represents a multiplet that contains a spin one boson, because that's called a vector particle in physics. There is a chiral multiplet, which works with minimal supersymmetry. By the way, is there anybody who can immediately correct my table, because there's something wrong with my table? I'm supposed to be writing down minimal supersymmetric. I've done something wrong.
Well, it seems weird that you wrote complex manifolds next to three dimensions.
I completely agree with that. That was what gave me pause. So there's something wrong with what I've written. Somehow this all has to be shifted, right? That's for even more supersymmetry, which is hard to write down in superspace. Well, there isn't a superspace for it. I was answering a question.
Well, I was asking, was hyper?
Yeah, yeah. So in the most familiar supersymmetric theory, there are things called chiral multiplets and vector multiplets. And then when you double the amount of supersymmetry, instead of chiral multiplets, you have hypermultiplets. And if you reduce to less supersymmetry, a hypermultiplet splits into two chirals, whereas an additionally supersymmetric vector multiplet splits into a vector plus a chiral in the weaker theory. Chiral multiplets tend to have, so these multiplets will then have certain numbers of scalar fields as part of the multiplet, and a vector multiplet, the number of scalar fields it has is dimension dependent, but a hypermultiplet always has quaternionic scalar fields no matter what dimension you're in. And that's one of the powerful things. We would like to understand some aspects of, for example, supersymmetric H theories, which deal with what possible expectation values a hypermultiplet can have, and that's always in some quaternionic space. And you can evaluate the space in any dimension you like. So sometimes it's convenient to take the theory in higher dimension, reduce it to lower dimension, do the calculation.
Like regarding your table, I think I know something, which is should be true that this number you write down, the one slash, is always a multiple of the number in front of. It's like, you know, when n equals 1.
No, so but I'm not using n equal 1, n equal 2. I'm using the number of spinners. So.
But that should be a multiple of the...
So it should be... the number of spinners is... So if I have a single spinner if I have n equal 1 in dimension 4, this is why my table was off.
That one should be 4.
That would be 4, right? And then if I reduce that to dimension 3, I'll have n equal 2 in dimension 3, because I still have 4 spinners, but the minimum number is 2. Okay. So the n is the ratio of how many there are to how many there, what's the minimal number that there could have been. Yeah. I'll do a better job of this table if I continue these lectures. More questions? Okay, thanks everybody for coming.
You moved to Hyper Taylor, now it's next to 6-dimensional, so it doesn't work. Let me.